Aloha, mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. We're keeping track of storms in the islands. We'll get an update from HPR's Derek Malama in just a moment. And then we'll hear about a new plant disease that could hit papayas here in Hawaii. It's already been found in Guam. So what is it, and what could that mean for agriculture here? Another question, maintenance at cemeteries. Oahu alone has more than 80 of them, some badly needing repairs. A new law could give one dilapidated cemetery in Pearl City new hope. With artificial intelligence reaching into just about every area of our lives, we'll hear from a Hawaii Island-born tech entrepreneur who's created an AI app just for kids. Aloha, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. A new plant disease could threaten more agricultural crops in our islands. Papaya farmers already likely know about ring spot, but a new affliction called papaya mushy canker disease has been identified in Guam, and it can kill a healthy papaya plant in less than 2 weeks. It's caused by bacteria that hitch a ride on invasive snails and slugs. So far, there's no way to treat an infected plant. Glenn Dula, assistant professor of plant pathology at the University of Guam, recently published the territory's first report about the bacteria. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about just how bad mushy canker disease is and the threat it poses to agriculture in Hawaii.
The papaya mushy canker disease has been present in the Pacific for several decades. In Guam, it's been around for quite a while. No one knows how long exactly. Anecdotally, it's been around since maybe the 70s or the 80s, but no one's actually ever isolated the pathogen or studied the disease. Coincidentally, there was a researcher from the University of Hawaii and a researcher from UC Berkeley that visited Micronesia, not Guam specifically, but they went to the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas in the late 70s, early 80s, and they observed the disease in the CNMI, in Saipan, Tinian, and Rota there first. The authors of that work were Edward Trujillo and Milton Schroth. So what Trujillo and Schroth found in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands is more than likely the same pathogen that we identified for the first time on Guam recently, but identified with DNA sequencing definitively, but anecdotally, it's been around for quite a while.
Mushy canker disease, it's one of those ones where you have an idea of what that looks like in your head, but could you describe some of the symptoms associated with that?
So mushy canker disease is characterized as a disease on papaya which produces soft rot symptoms. Typically, the bacteria will enter the plant tissue and start to degrade and hydrolyze the tissue. So what it produces is these dark lesions that kind of look like they're water soaked. It's kind of like, it looks like a dark green or dark black spot on the plant. So it affects the leaves, the stems, and eventually just rots it to the point where the plant itself will lose integrity and flop over and die. It can also rot the fruit itself. Papaya is a huge tropical agricultural commodity for Hawaii. You know, it would have serious economic implications. For Guam, since this pathogen has been around for a while, and although we haven't documented it out in the agricultural community with any specific or great detail, we've heard stories where farmers have given up on growing papaya because the pathogen or the disease spreads so quickly and it rots out their papaya seedlings. And even if it is in a mature papaya field, the fruit isn't of a quality that is sellable or marketable. I'm a microbiologist by training, so I love the idea of studying plant microbe interactions, how the bacteria moves from one plant to another plant, how it enters the plant. I'm more of a basic science kind of person. So I like how this pathogen in particular interacts with its host and with itself and with its vector. So pathogens also spread by a different kind of invasive species. It's vectored by mollusks, specifically the giant African snail. And then current research in my lab is looking at other mollusk vectors that may or may not transmit this bacterial pathogen.
Did I miss that in the paper, that this bacteria is spread potentially by a land snail, an invasive land snail?
Oh, yeah. It is vectored by the giant African snail. We found that it's also vectored by the Cuban slug. It's a common garden pest, which makes it even more important for us.
That then kind of paints this picture of introduction and spread, right? Because when you have some of the first documented instances of this showing up in the scientific literature, you always have to think, okay, is that actually when it was turning up here? Or is that just when scientists started paying attention to it? But if we're thinking about the life cycle of this bacteria, how it spreads from plant to plant, and the interplay with this invasive land snail, it did have to arrive in the Pacific Islands a lot more recently.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the reasons why I started studying this and started paying attention to it, because before I became a professor here, I was an invasive species natural resources manager. So I worked on coconut rhinoceros beetle, little fire ants, and all sorts of different invasive ants, including the giant African snail. So coming into plant pathology, there was that linkage there. And it's well known that the giant African snail and the Cuban slug are common garden pests, and they travel really easily on conveyances, like shipping containers, trucks, potting soil, plants. So they move very well from island to island. So possibly this pathogen has been moving around forever, ever since the giant African snail was introduced to Guam in World War II by the Japanese.
And so then there also is this fear that the pathogen could travel to other places. So for instance, from Guam to Hawaii, and the kind of economic issues that might pose.
Oh yeah, for sure. Guam and Hawaii have a special relationship when it comes to invasive species. So we have the saying on Guam, if it's found in Hawaii, give it maybe 3 to 4 years and eventually it will make its way to Guam in regards to invasive species, or vice versa. So when it's found on Guam, it'll eventually make its way to Hawaii. Since we're so interconnected through transport, our only connection to the mainland always runs through Hawaii. So we are a huge quarantine risk to Hawaii. And Hawaii understands that. So USDA and every quarantine agency sees us as a huge risk. And, you know, it kind of does hold true because we received little fire ants maybe 4 or 5 years after it was established in Hawaii. And same thing with the coconut rhinoceros beetle. In 2007, Guam received the coconut rhinoceros beetle from some unknown source. And then I believe in 2012, exactly, Oahu had its first record of the coconut rhinoceros beetle.
Is there anything that you can do right now for papaya mushy canker disease?
No, not that I know of. So that would be future work to try to understand the disease mechanics and how to prevent the spread of the pathogen. But honestly, it's like a lot of other bacterial pathogens. It's spread primarily by rain splash and wind. So once it's introduced, being in the tropics, Hawaii is not as rainy and humid as Guam. But Guam, we get torrential downpours all the time. And once the pathogen establishes in an agricultural field, it spreads like wildfire. So I believe probably quarantine practices, no illegal smuggling, movement of clean plant tissue products, clean seeds, would be the best way to prevent the spread to other islands. Within an agricultural field, the only way you could stop it is to prevent the leaves from getting wet and to prevent snails and slugs from entering your nursery or field, which is almost impossible, quite honestly. If a snail or a slug were to munch on the leaf or the stem, I don't know if it's overstating, but it's kind of a death sentence. So once it's introduced into the vascular system or into the tissue, the bacteria just proliferates and creates these giant lesions, which lead to stem death. Not death.
I feel like we've been talking about, and especially here, you just hear a laundry list of all these plant pathogens, invasive species. It can feel a little like an uphill battle, but I guess from your end, what are the questions that you're most interested in answering, and how do you tie this all back in to give people a sense that they're not just like doomed to their farms and papayas being overrun by diseases like this?
I think now that mushy canker disease is at least being studied by myself, it'll move to the next level where collaborators, hopefully my collaborators here at the university, will start to develop management strategies around it. Once the research is out there and you put it in the light of the USDA or some other higher government agency, they realize the importance of it and they will fund further research to help manage this pathogen. So we do have funding now from USDA to create better detection methods for this group of pathogens with more tools available to quarantine officers. It'll be easier for them to identify the pathogen and say, okay, this is definitely not in Hawaii, and then they can take action on the quarantine material.
Is there anything else kind of on this topic you wanted to say or feel like listeners should know about or be thinking about?
So again, I come from a quarantine background, biosecurity background. So threat and spreading these invasive species or plant diseases are people themselves. They don't understand the importance of bringing a single piece of fruit on the plane with you from Guam to Hawaii or from some foreign country into the United States. They see it, okay, it's just a piece of fruit. It looks perfectly fine. But for quarantine officials, it's a huge nightmare. And it scares us because, you know, it's so easy to sneak a piece of fruit in with no malice or malintent and then chuck it out into a trash can or into the environment, and it just releases another invasive species or introduces a new plant disease. And especially with globalization of everything and the availability of seeds and plants from everywhere, eBay, Amazon, it's crazy. It's like there's no way that we can keep up with the movement of quarantine material anywhere in the mail through any conveyance. But I would just say, just educate yourself and understand the risks associated with moving plant material to your home island.
Yeah, take those rules seriously. And if you're going to eat a piece of fruit, do it at the airport before you leave.
Yeah, yeah.
Or don't bring it to the airport at all.
Yeah, yeah. Airport food sucks, but it's safer that way.
That was University of Guam plant pathologist Glenn Dula talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about papaya mushy canker disease. We'll have a link to his new study on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Urban explorers poke around abandoned buildings, checking out what's been left behind. It's not always legal, but it is a way to document history.
For me, it's a way to save these places, at least in my pictures, to preserve them.
All good fun until you get charged with spying for Russia. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
A Pearl City cemetery that's fallen into disrepair may get a makeover thanks to developments coming from a new law. HPR reporter Cassie Ordonia is here to tell us about that. And Cassie, I know you've been out there on more than one occasion, and it sounds like quite a scene.
It's my second time that I've been to that cemetery, and it looks the same from when I went to it last time in 2023. When you go into the cemetery, it totally looks abandoned, even though some of their residents and volunteers who care for it say it's gotten better. But when you go in, the crypt, for example, was infested with beehives, and the doors where they would store bodies or urns completely ripped open. I even saw like a sleeping bag in there. So obviously there are people experiencing homelessness who have been sleeping on this property. And then it gets even worse. The rooftops are crumbling. And the worst part of the cemetery is you go to the mausoleum area, and it's mostly Japanese and Pacific Islander families who were buried there. Mm. It smells like cat feces. So imagine if you own a cat and you haven't changed their litter box for a week or two, that's what it smells like. Even going in, me and the Pearl City Neighborhood Board Chair, Larry Veray, when we were walking deeper into the cemetery, the mausoleum area, we were even stepping over human feces. And also high winds also had this monkey pod branch fall into some of the grave markers. And then the last part of the cemetery is that people were dumping their trash there. And in the story that aired today, Larry Veray was even saying, who dumps their dishwasher in a cemetery? But that trash area was when it was just cleaned up 2 days ago when I arrived. And Larry Veray said it was 6 feet tall. 2 days later, it's 3 feet tall. So that's kind of like a glimpse of what you're going to see at that cemetery. But this new law does provide a glimpse of hope. It does give the Department of Commerce and Consumers Affairs, it permits them to allow the nonprofit Friends of Sunset Memorial Park to have limited ownership. Before, they couldn't call the police on vandals or trespassers or people who are sleeping in the cemetery, but the cops couldn't really do anything about it because the residents didn't really own the cemetery since the owner died more than 12 years ago. But I know Larry Veray was the one who created this nonprofit, Sunset Memorial Park, and he says the cemetery still relies on volunteers to maintain the property. And the owner of the cemetery, who goes by the name of Slim, died more than 12 years ago.
My plan is to bring in volunteers with construction skills and go ahead and rebuild some of those with the grants that I hope for us to get. Again, part of that revitalization, rejuvenation of the cemetery, put it back the way it would have looked years ago, but also bring in today what the families would like to see. And of course, usually when I raise the bar, it's usually pretty high. And I always ask the families, we're planning on having probably a town hall meeting either the first or second Saturday of September up at Waiau District Park. And I'll bring the families together and I'm going to ask them, let's chart out, what do you want to see in your cemetery? What do you want it to look like? I said, this is your opportunity, and we'll do the best we can to make it happen. My high standards are when I go over to the North Shore, and of course we've got veteran cemeteries, we got the state cemetery, and then you got the cemetery of all cemeteries. You got Valley of the Temples. And when you look at that, it's just beautiful. That's a standard that I want to make for Pearl City. And the other thing is I want this to be a historical area where people can come and as they drive through Pearl City and says, hey, what's this Sunset Memorial Park Cemetery? And I want to have some type of kiosk to give you the history of that cemetery and the people. There's actually one individual that was in the Civil War.
Boy, Larry Verrey there, as you said, the chair of the Pearl City Neighborhood Board, certainly some aspirational thoughts on that. But you cover culture as part of your beat, and certainly you talk about cemeteries, and some of the ones that he mentioned there, certainly a reflection of cultural value, history, and importance.
And when you look at cemeteries now and you talk to people, whether loved ones, family, friends, colleagues, you kind of ask yourself, how do you want to die or how do you want to be buried? There are some people who would rather go the old-fashioned way, just be buried at a ground burial, for example, or be buried in the crypt area. But there's some people who are opting more for cremation. And one of the reasons why people are opting more for cremation is because it's a lot more affordable than a burial. And then it's also less maintenance. When you have that urn, you could either have a plot sale where I didn't know you can actually bury the urn or put them in a columbarium or a crypt area. You could actually take the urn with you. So it's low maintenance and it's less costly.
And it's interesting in terms of the efforts at preservation. Certainly, this is not the only case, Sunset Memorial Park. And the law that you were talking about that allows some more, if not flexibility, certainly some hope in this direction.
Yeah, and the law would also provide that pathway for future cemeteries that are falling to disrepair, or maybe their owner passed away or the nonprofit can no longer care for it, because some of these cemeteries have a very old business model to where you sell all the plots, that's all the revenues that you have, and once those revenues dry up because you're paying for ground maintenance, that's it. Mm-hmm. So let's say this new law now like Manoah Chinese Cemetery, for example, if something happened to the nonprofit, a new nonprofit could take over. But there's another law established in 1967 that already requires cemeteries to be licensed and put money into their own perpetual care fund. That's a trust fund, basically. But there are only 13 cemeteries in the entire state that created a trust. And I only know that Oahu alone has about 80 public cemeteries.
Mm. Quite a differential. And in this case, in particular, talk about the law and lawmakers, and there's a personal connection there in this case.
That's right. Representative Greg Takayama was the one who introduced the bill that just became law this year, and he has family members that are buried there, and he said that this has been a long time coming, and they really got their work cut out for them for this cemetery. The nonprofit can now install security cameras, for example. They can call the cops. And this wasn't made possible before.
Problem was both resources and the legal responsibility. For example, you know, the fact that we had drug users, drug abusers, vandals at the cemetery, there was no way that even though we knew that they were there, we saw them there, we couldn't call the police and have them evicted because the police would say, okay, well, you're making the complaint, but do you own the cemetery? And we could never say, yes, we own the cemetery and be able to sign the citation for the police department. This makes it possible. Now we can say so-and-so is trespassing. We see them there, call the police, and the representatives of the nonprofit can say, yes, we have responsibility for managing the cemetery. Therefore, we have authority to sign the complaint. And the police can go ahead and, you know, evict or arrest them, whoever's trespassing. So that's made possible under this new law. That wasn't possible before.
You know, laws making certain changes, but certainly, again, just a reminder of the importance of community volunteers in doing this here in Sunset Memorial Park and at cemeteries around the state.
It really does take a community to maintain the cemeteries, but for how long that will be, we're not too sure, just because the older generation, they're getting older, and is it going to be up to the younger generation? That's really up to them.
step by step, but an initial step in a positive direction, sounds like. Thank you, Cassie. HPR's Cassie Ordonia, we've been talking to her about her latest story. You can read that and more of her stories online at her website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin September 23rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
This week on Point, we start our special week-long series on mining and our clean energy future. The U.S. sits on some of the largest lithium reserves in the world. Why aren't we mining more of it?
I started working there, and I was a drill and powder helper out in the mine. We closed it down in 85, let the mine fill up with water.
Our series, Elements of Energy, begins on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Artificial intelligence. It's taking a growing role in many areas of our daily lives, and more than a few parents are wondering how their children can safely navigate the internet and other emerging technology that use AI. Darius Monsef is a longtime tech entrepreneur who grew up on the Big Island. He's a father and a Make-A-Wish Hawaii board member. Many of his recent startups have been focused on child safety. His newest project is the Genie AI app. It was created to give children a safe experience on the internet through the use of artificial intelligence as a sidekick or guardian. The conversation's Russell Subiona got the chance to talk to Monsef about the app.
What prompted you to want to create Genie to address this particular issue?
Yeah, I guess there's two things. One, in the startup world, there's a common phrase about solving your own problems. Ideally, we like intimately connected to a problem and really want to solve it, which is what spurs us to want to create companies. And the other was, in the history of my work, and I've been on the board of Make-A-Wish Hawaii for a few years because I care deeply about kids and giving them every opportunity to succeed. And my previous startup was about children's healthcare. Coming out of that was really solidifying for me. I want to build for kids and for parents. And solving my own problems, my middle kid is competitive with video games. And it means she skill matches with often people much older than her and often men. And that could and should be fine. And it's nice for her to have a voice comm on to talk to a teammate and organize play. But I can't trust her talking with her voice to some guy somewhere on the internet. So Genie came from this place of, man, this AI is going to unlock an ability. I can't live in my kids' conversations, every single one they have on the internet. I can't protect my kid everywhere they go on the internet. But there's a way for us to build an AI that can kind of be that good angel on the shoulder or the guardian that goes with them and looks for these things and gives them the like, something's up here. Maybe you shouldn't do that. Or here's a different way that you should approach this.
So you created Genie. It's an app that kids can use. What can they do on Genie? How can they use it?
Yeah, I think the first thing before I get to the features is that I think it's appropriate for parents to have a healthy skepticism everybody should. And the internet, in that it provides access to so much more information, and also provides much more access to misinformation. And I've seen it with some parents. There's kind of a distrust to tech bros or tech companies that are there just to prey on people's weaknesses, to get them addicted to games and to prey on their money. that does exist. And so we get some of it. And I don't react with a negative, like, hey, why are you looking at us this way? It's, well, the broader industry behaves badly. That's exactly why we're trying to build Genie, is if we don't leverage this technology in the best way possible for kids, other people are going to use it in ways that just prey on their vulnerabilities. So it was something that we really cared about to build. And so right now, Genie is an AI sidekick for kids. We're clear to call it a sidekick and not a friend, because a friend should hold equal space in a relationship. And Genie's sole purpose is to be the sidekick, to set the kid up to be successful, be the hero of that story. So it's conversational. They can chat with it. They can play word games, make up stories collaboratively. They can create generative art. And it provides access to the entirety of information that's online, but always in an age-appropriate way. Because the internet's kind of binary. You either give your kids Safari or a web browser and they have access to everything or nothing. And for a young, curious mind that really wants to learn, they can ask Genie, hey, where did the metric system come from? And instead of a Google search and clicking through websites and whatever ads and stuff would be there, they just ask Genie and Genie gives them the information. And that it is always age appropriate. So if you ask a sensitive subject question, Genie would answer it appropriately for a kid's age. And often just default to, hey, that's kind of a sensitive thing. And you should probably talk to a trusted adult like your parent about that. So it's not trying to replace the role of a parent. It's not trying to replace the importance of human interaction. It's meant to be like, if we imagine kids do get screen time, what could a healthy alternative be to that screen time that isn't just purely passive? It's creative. It's engaged. And underneath the hood is a bit of learning and experiencing.
One other thing that I read on your website is that you built Genie to be a supportive, kind, and encouraging companion for children that helps them when they're feeling alone, sad, or helpless. And you talked a little bit about how Genie is a sidekick. How does Genie help a child when they have these vulnerable kinds of feelings, feelings that parents should also be aware of? How does that dynamic work?
We had a good example of that recently. We spot check messages. Obviously, we're trying to audit to make sure that all these things we promise to people are true in the way Genie communicates with kids. And there was a kid that came in and basically just said, I'm really in a bad mood. I'm really sad. I'm mad. And that she had a disagreement with her mom and left that telling Genie, I think my mom wants a different kid. You know, this kid is really sad and feels like there's no place. And Genie said, you know, that's a difficult thing to feel, but it's okay that you talk to your mom about it. You could say, hey, when you do or say this, it makes me really sad. Can we talk about it? And the kid said, I'm not ready to talk about that yet, but let's make up a story with, I think, farting. And Genie's like, oh, okay. And they just played and they made this story up. At the end of this little play session, the girl said, okay, I'm going to go talk to my parents now. And so for me as a parent, like, that's exactly what I want. Like, we have issues of my emotions are up, kids' emotions are up, some conflict. To know that my kid is going to turn to something that can chat with, that's just going to be patient. And, you know, if they've maybe gone to one of their friend might have just said, yeah, parents suck. And like, that's fine. That's part of life. But to have Genie be a reflection and a place to like, hey, let's calm down and then go have this constructive conversation with the parent. That's what I want as a parent. And really, we're building it for ourselves.
The New York Times recently published an article on how schools and school policies are struggling to keep up with the pace of technology, which has led to AI abuse in some schools. How important is it for young kids to be taught to use AI ethically now before they are older and encounter opportunities to use AI for the wrong purpose?
I would apply that to just general good internet citizenry skills, which is also what Genie's trying to do. If you try and share a home address, Genie's going to say, hey, that's really not something safe to share online. So it's teaching these kids these skills in a safe and contained place. Because at some point, sooner than parents often want, your kid's going to be on Snapchat and TikTok and all these other apps where if they didn't learn good behaviors and skills, they really can get themselves into dangerous positions. And so it'd be similar with using AI to cheat and get your homework done. But just like anything that's happened with technology, when the computer word processors first came out, like you could cheat because you could copy and paste things. And so we had to go, okay, there's a healthy way to do that. And there's a way to cheat. And then the internet, like a digital Wikipedia, means you can just go copy whole articles. So there's just been an evolution of this is a new tool, and a new tool can always be abused, but it can also be used in a really positive way. And you know, the challenge of a parent who has to learn very quickly, not only the things in their world, but the one also in their children's world. What is a way in which I can address kind of the challenges of this, but also embracing the opportunities?
I think one thing a parent might wonder about Genie is security. How is it secure when a child is using it on the internet? Has it been accredited, or are there overseeing organizations that put their seal of approval on it? What kind of oversight or security is there for the Genie app?
Yeah, so we started specifically building for kids and focusing on kids under 12 because they have, from the government mandated, a different set of compliance that if you're building for kids under 12, you have to build privacy and security that you don't have to. Unfortunately, you know, the joke is sort of like two kids in a trench coat. Facebook just says, hey, are you over 12? And the kid goes, yep. So for sites that build for specifically kids under 12, COPPA is the Child Online Privacy and Protection Act. Those are the legal requirements around if a kid is going to share personal information about themselves with others, you have to get a parent's consent. And parental consent is like scanning the government ID. It's kind of a cumbersome and heavy process. But there are compliance and regulations around COPPA for building for kids under 12. We work with a company called KidSafe that does kind of the auditing of us, and we're working towards our compliance. We obviously just started as a startup, so it takes time to work towards that. But we do things like we ask for a kid's first and last name, but the last name doesn't go anywhere to us and it doesn't leave the kid's device. It's stored on the device specifically to block the kid from future sharing it, because first name is something the kid can share and can put online because it's hard to narrow that kid down. But when tied to a last name, it becomes this indicator of who they are. And so we do things like that to prevent unintentional sharing where, yeah, we want to teach a kid how to be on the internet, but we're also trying to prevent unintended ways in which kids share things that they shouldn't.
Maybe if you can share with parents how they can get Genie and how it optimizes their experience, their children's experience with it.
We are parents specifically building. My kids all use Genie, so I'm in it right along with everybody else. And we're doing it because we really want to give every kid the opportunity to reach their full potential. Technology just continues to move fast. It becomes more and more accessible. Now kids are getting cell phones. They're even more connected in even more isolated ways. So we embrace the idea of AI being an assistant for us to help protect kids. It's like leverage that power for good rather than to just leave it into the hands of those that would prey on the vulnerabilities of people. So there really is an opportunity to create something that is always accessible for a kid, that is patient, is kind. It acts like that inspiring coach or teacher. It's an empathetic friend who never is having their own bad mood that might put that other kid in a bad mood. They're just always there in a positive and empathetic way to just encourage that kid to go live more, experience more. The goal of Genie is not to get a kid to not be outside, to not touch grass, to not have real life friends. For our company, our highest priority is helping a kid be successful holistically. That means the kid can't spend all day on Genie. They need to go outside. They need to play. They need to physically move. And so we're aligned in building a company that creates the best opportunities for kids. And our app is in the App Store, the Apple App Store right now. You can find it searching for genie.gg, or you can find it on our website, which is genie.gg as well.
Darius Montsev, thanks so much for your time this morning.
I appreciate you.
Getting some intergenerational help from artificial intelligence. Really fascinating discussion with Genie AI app co-creator Darius Montsev, talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. We'll have a link to more information about the Genie app on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30. Here on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
The 2024 Masters and Teen CrossFit Games will be held this weekend. Water events have been removed from the global competition after an athlete drowned at the games earlier this month. Big Island resident Cheryl Brost will be defending her title of fittest woman on Earth this year. Last year, she finished first in the women's 50 to 54 division, and she enters this year's competition ranked second in the world. With that coming up, take another listen to a discussion the Conversation's Russell Subiono had with Brost after her victory last year.
How did it feel to be back on the podium?
It felt amazing to stand back on top of the podium this year, and I've had lots of opportunities to go to the games, been blessed that way. I really enjoyed each and every experience in its own right. I've had a few surgeries since 2017. Since I last stood on top of the podium, you know, maybe that played a role, you know, in the previous two trips to the games, you know, not quite making the podium. Last year was very close. I was literally 10 points out of a tie for second. So yeah, it felt amazing and very rewarding to be able to overcome injuries I've had and still know that I can compete at that very top level. And the bonus for me, especially this year, was my best friend who I've met through CrossFit 5 years ago stood right next to me. She came in second, Nicole Abbott.
That makes the occasion even better. Yeah.
It was like a picture perfect, like couldn't write a better script. I really enjoy all the competitors in our age division. Nicole and I are remote training partners It's just been amazing. Like, she lives in South Carolina, I live in Hawaii, but it feels like we've known each other for our whole lives, but it's only been a little over 5 years. So I was super happy for her to stand on top of the podium her first time. So yeah, super stoked for her. And she's had some big surgeries that she's overcome as well with her shoulders.
I think one of my favorite things about CrossFit is the friends that you make, like the lifelong friends that you make.
Yeah, and right?
Yeah, and being in the workout and being able to turn to your friend and, mm-hmm. you know, and just encourage them or hearing them encourage you.
Exactly.
I had a handful of friends like that. We were always the last person to finish in the WOD, but, you know, it was fun. It made it fun. And that was more important than anything else, I think.
And literally I could with her at the games this year because she qualified coming into the games fifth. I qualified coming into the game sitting in third. So how they do the lane assignment, third and fifth, our lanes are right next to each other.
Oh, perfect.
And so each day they would reset the lane assignment based on the previous day's performances. And we were like 1 and 2 or 1 and 3. So we would be right by each other, side by side, every event through the whole games.
I can imagine that just pushed and motivated you both even more. Was there anything else that you credit for your success this year? Did you do anything different in your training program?
You know, that's a good question. Our son got married literally the weekend before the games. So I knew that was coming up. And, you know, I almost did not compete this year just because I didn't want to be a distraction from the family and his wedding and is our first child getting married. And my coaches knew I was contemplating. I went through all the qualifiers, of course, and just left my options open. And then Nicole, she had to go qualify. And so I could not not go to the game.
Right, right.
And it worked out well. I mean, it actually was really ideal in terms of the lead up. You know, it's kind of you're deloading that week. And we had a great time. The wedding was beautiful. And so I think we just kind of carried that swell of a high, emotional high, you know, heading into the games. And back up a step before, though, is once I made the decision I was going to go for the games, I had a chat, both Nicole and I had a chat with our coach. We have the same coach, about what training was going to look like leading up to the games. We had, I think, about our longest time period we've ever had between qualifiers and the actual games competition. We had over 2 months to train and get ready for the games. And so we sat down with coach and, you know, basically kind of gave her our goals and how we wanted train to look this summer. We wanted to be prepared, but we didn't want to come into the games injured, or we didn't want to come into the games overtrained. We wanted to be feel fresh and ready to take on whatever's asked of us. And I thought coach did an amazing job balancing that for us. And the training was tons of fun. I could get in the gym and mostly get it done between 2 to 3 hours on the longer days, but it still gave me plenty of time to do other fun stuff.
It sounds like it was like a perfect combination of like all this positive energy,
yeah,
you know, from like your son's wedding and your mm-hmm. friendship and good training. And I know obviously training for the workouts in the games is a critical part of being successful in the competition. But I imagine there's also kind of the small details on the periphery that also contribute to the difference between first place and the rest of the pack. What are some of the small things that as a champion you have to pay attention to?
Geez, yeah. I would say, you know, my experience in the sport all these years paid off. I think being able to handle nerves and anxiety heading into an event, like the finale, for example, I don't know if you realize, but I was heading into the finale, I was sitting in third place, but I was literally only 10 or 20 points out of first. But I knew going into that event, I just needed to win it, you know, to take care of my own destiny. And fortunately for me, it was a good workout for me. And it was super fun. That was probably one of my most favorite events of the games. I mean, there was a couple others I really liked, but that was has to top it off as being the most favorite event. 20 bar muscle ups for time right into 30 alternating dumbbell squat snatches. It was a quick one and super fun. Just feels like you're a kid on the playground, you know, right? Playing on the monkey bars. And
you posted on social media not long ago that sleep is a critical component of your overall physical and mental health. How much should athletes be paying attention to the sleep that they get? How does that contribute to their success?
Oh my gosh, there's so much recovery that's happening during sleep. And, you know, when you're hitting that deep sleep as well. I was starting to kind of go through a cycle. I think it, a lot of people at our age experience where, you know, you start waking up in the middle of the night and then, you know, rather than being able to turn over and go right back to sleep, you're just laying there staring at the ceiling or, you know, trying to get your mind to turn off. Or I started to have those happening, like I would say this spring, and I'd lay there for an hour or more wide awake. So actually this company, Thirdsy, reached out to me and they said that they had a sleep supplement that a lot of CrossFit athletes have been really enjoying. And I hadn't heard of it before. And they offered to send me a sample. And that stuff is amazing. Like the first night it worked for me. I take it like an hour before I go to bed. It's the L-theanine, GABA, magnesium, and oh geez, there's some collagen protein in there as well. It helps you go to sleep, but it also, I found it helps me if I do wake up to go to the bathroom or whatever, I'm able to go back to sleep much, much, much sooner, like almost within minutes. So I was tracking my sleep and my sleep numbers went up from, I would say, averaging 7 hours a night to 9.5 hours a night. So I have numerous nights where I was getting 10 hours sleep heading into the games. Well, maybe not the week of the wedding, but but all that, I think, paid off in the end. I felt, my body felt refreshed and restored and ready to take on the next day's training or whatever I had on the schedule.
I think a lot of times the recovery part of training is overlooked by mm-hmm. the general public. But when it comes to the rest and recovery, I feel like that should get a lot more or as equal attention.
That's super critical, especially as we age. Our bodies get so tight and fascia gets just matted down. And in addition to my weekly massages with my body worker and chiropractic work as well, it's almost a necessity to stay on top of the game, you know, in your sport. You got to commit time to those things.
This is my last question for you, Cheryl. Does winning the games, does it ever get old?
No. Heck no. It's super fun when you prepare, spend so much time working to prepare for something, and for it to all go, you know, as you hoped or planned, and to come out on top. It's, winning's always fun. It's right. Not my focus, but it certainly is super fun when it happens.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Cheryl. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, Russell.
CrossFit Games champion Cheryl Bross talking with HPR's Russell Subiono last August. She's now traveling to Alabama to defend her title in the women's 50 to 54 division of the 2024 Masters CrossFit Games. That's the program for today. Straight ahead, an update on the aftermath of what is now Tropical Storm Hone. Tomorrow, some storm context from the Big Island. And we'll hear about a new website created by Kaiser Permanente Hawaii and Maui High School students. It's designed to inform the next generation about healthcare careers and hopefully attract them to the industry. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify, Apple, anywhere you tune in for podcasts. And you can reach out at our talkback line, 808-792-8217. I'm Bill Dorman in for Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.